Okay, good morning, everybody. We're going to get started. My voice is somewhat on the fritz, but it's much better than it was a couple of days ago. Although then, at least when I spoke on the Noah film, I had a microphone, so that was handy. So we'll do our best. Today we're going to do Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, who is really one of the great thinkers of the 20th century, also one of the great halachists. He was one of the leading students, if not the leading students, of Rabbi Ben Tzion Uziel, who we talked about last time. And we're just continuing on the same path as last week in terms of trying to deal with what halacha does when you have a world that's almost entirely different from the world in, or the worlds in which the halachic sources, the classic halachic sources, were written. And what every halachist needs to do is to distill, and not everybody agrees on how to distill it, but everybody needs to be a master of the classical sources, to distill the principles, and then to figure out how to best apply these principles to a modern world. And so last week we dealt with Rabbi Uziel, today we're going to deal with Rabbi Halevi. And I'm specifically choosing areas that we didn't talk about last time. In other words, last time we could have dealt with the same things of Rabbi Uziel, but for the sake of mixing it up, I thought it would be important to deal with another arena. So we'll start with science. Up until now, we've spoken about the interface between faith and science and how Rambam in particular paved a path in the 12th century that we're still working with today, even though, of course, science and philosophy are very different now than they were in the 12th century. But the principles that Rambam developed are still very relevant now. But that was in terms of faith and belief in the literalness of the Torah, or how to deal with the interpretation of the Torah. How do you deal with that in science? I'll give you an example. We all love blessings. Our halakha has codified zillions of blessings for everything, some of which we recite regularly, like if we're having a drink or eating anything, many blessings which we recite in our prayer liturgy. But then you have the occurrence, the five senses blessings. So for example, if you smell something fragrant, there's a blessing that you make on smells, and there's even different blessings for if you're smelling a leafy fragrant thing or if you're smelling cloves. You have blessings for everything. You have blessings for natural wonders, including seeing the Mediterranean Sea, which if you have beachfront property, you won't recite actually, because, no, that's the rule. It has to be something special. So if you're seeing the Mediterranean Sea for the first time in 30 days, then you can make a blessing. But if you live there and you're looking at it on a daily basis, then you make it once, done. And then if you go on a 30 plus day trip and come back, you can make it again. Every time there's a thunderstorm, there's a blessing for thunder and there's a different blessing for lightning. And then if there's a rainbow after that, there's another blessing for that. We have blessings for everything. We're constantly thinking about God, or at least, let's put it this way, we should constantly thinking about God. I think it was George who mentioned a few weeks ago in the context of fear of God. There's probably no better trick that the Jewish people have, if you take it seriously, than making blessings for everything. We're constantly aware, both in the regular and the not regular and the semi-regular, there are blessings for everything. And so that's the principle. It's a very easy one to understand. Now, what about solar or lunar eclipses? Should we make a blessing on them?
I haven't heard that.
The criterion, the principle is we bless God whenever there's a natural wonder.
Why not?
Well, it's still natural, right?
It is, and we've also had great triumphs sometimes due to eclipses, so I would think it's something, in fact, you want to say something.
Absolutely. So it happens that the Talmud does not codify a blessing for eclipses, even though they're spectacular, and they're, you would think that would be even make even more sense than, let's say, thunder. It's like, here's something that's really unusual, they publicize it in the paper, it's like a meteor shower. That's, you know, like the things that are really special. People camp out all night, watch them, you know, for that 1 minute or the 10-minute window, whatever it is, for it to become available. Why is there no blessing on eclipses? Because the Talmud, in a non-legal passage, talks of, it believed that solar and lunar eclipses were a sign of divine wrath. If there's a solar eclipse, that means that God is angry at the world. If there's a lunar eclipse, that means that God is angry at Israel. So, of course, we don't make blessings for things like that. So somebody asked Rabbi Halevi, knowing, generally speaking, we bless God for natural wonders, and knowing that the Talmud views solar and lunar eclipses as curses, what should we do in the 20th century, or now the 21st century, now that we don't think it's a sign of divine wrath? We think it's a natural wonder. Scientists can predict when eclipses are going to come, and it has nothing to do with their moral assessment about whether God is angry at the world. You can predict that they happen. That's what they thought. And they weren't alone. A lot of people in the good old days thought that. But the question is, now we think differently. So the question is, what changes? Do we say, look, the Talmud didn't codify a blessing, so we have no right to do it? Should we insist, no, it's obviously still a sign of divine wrath? Or should we say, look, that's what their halakha is predicated on, a different assumption from the one that we have. What should we do? It's a very interesting question, right? It seems trivial, but it's actually very important, not only in terms of should we make a blessing, but how dogmatically do we view the Talmudic principle that it's a sign of divine wrath? Is it a rabbinic rule? Or is it just what they believed, because that was the science of their time? So somebody called in Rabbi Halevi on his radio show. Mm-hmm. That's how a lot of his writings, a lot of them started. He had a radio show called Aseh Lecha Rav. It was an Ask the Rabbi thing. He would get on the air. Hello, Rabbi Halevi, on the air? Okay, you're on the air. And somebody would call in and say, hi, should we make blessings on solar eclipses and lunar eclipses? And he would just off the cuff fire off an answer. And then later on, he wrote them up and published them in his collection called Aseh Lecha Rav. Probably, you know. And then he also added written responsa. So how did he deal with this? Rabbi Halevi is a diehard traditionalist who had both eyes on, he had both eyes open to reality today. He knew all the sources. He knew reality. So he's caught in the horns of a dilemma. Should we coin a new blessing, or even use a pre-existing blessing that the rabbis used for, let's say, thunder or lightning, and just have some general, you know, we have a blessing, Oseh Maaseh Bereishit, God bless you for creating all of creation. Okay, so throw that in there. You don't even have to invent a new eclipse blessing. Rabbi Halevi balanced it. He said, look, I agree, since science can't predict eclipses, that means that it's not a sign of divine wrath. He backed away from the Talmudic belief. He said that that was rooted in an ancient scientific belief. But we know better. He accepted that principle. He said, we're not going to insist that it's divine wrath if scientists who don't believe in anything can tell you exactly when the next lunar eclipse is going to be to the minute. So he accepted that. But he also was reluctant as a traditionalist to invent a new blessing, or even to say, we should make a blessing on something that the Talmud told us not to. So he comes up with, why don't we say biblical verses? And he came up with a liturgy. He said, this is how we can praise God without inventing a rabbinic style blessing. So what's he trying to do here? I'm interested in the principle, not just on what to do with an eclipse. He's upholding, He's trying to bridge. He doesn't want to invent a new blessing because he considers that non-traditional. But he also doesn't want to just accept dogmatically a scientific axiom of the sages when we have demonstrated conclusively that eclipses are realities of science. And therefore, that was how he bridged it there. Another question, smoking. I have very strong opinions on it, but I'll keep them out of it for the time being. Smoking. Cigarettes, cigars, pipes, you name it. We've been smoking it for centuries, right? And in the olden days, what questions did rabbis deal with most significantly in smoking? In the good old days, people thought it was healthful. So nobody thought, is it okay to smoke? That was never on the agenda of rabbis in previous generations. The only question that was serious that halachas wrestled with is, are you allowed to smoke on Yom Tov?
On a fast day.
Or on a fast day. Because on the one hand, you're deriving benefit. You're allowed to transfer a fire. You're just not allowed to light a new fire on Yom Tov as opposed to Shabbat. Shabbat, for sure, it's not okay. But on Yom Tov, and most rabbinic decisors decided it's probably okay to smoke on Yom Tov, and it even adds to your joy. And it's probably okay to smoke on a fast day because at the end of the day, it's not eating. Well, what happens when all kinds of new research pours in? And not only that, this is an important factor as well. Many great rabbis in previous generations smoked. And there's a great reluctance in halakha to condemn earlier generations of rabbis and their rulings. There's a great reluctance. You can disagree. Rabbis disagree all the time. But if somebody were to say smoking is prohibited, you're not just disagreeing with a principle that some earlier rabbi said. You're saying earlier generations of rabbis were sinners. And then there's another principle. Just, there's a biblical law. We must take care of our bodies. Our bodies are gifts from God. We must be healthful. We're not allowed to endanger ourselves or deliberately harm ourselves. And there are even discussions over what kind of risk are you allowed to take. You know, you're allowed to take reasonable risks, but you're not supposed to take unreasonable risks to your health. So in the good old days, when all the rabbis were discussing smoking, it wasn't an unreasonable risk. It was in fact considered healthful, or at least not harmful. What happens when all this new research pours in that smoking can kill you? And not only does it kill you, but it kills all the people around you. Right? So does the rule change? What do we do? So somebody called in Rabbi Halevi. Hello, you're on the air. Are we allowed to smoke? So what should he say? What should we do? These are real serious questions. In other words, this obviously affects a lot more day-to-day lives of a lot more people than a solar eclipse.
Well, Maimonides would say,
science indicates that it's unhealthy, so that's what you have to consider. But if you're being unhealthy to your body, Halakha says that's really not something you should do either. Yet, there's a long tradition of both, and therefore, it's a matter of your own discretion. So, knowing both sides of it, to choose what fits you best.
So, yeah, Eric?
Why is it a problem? Isn't that a contradiction to Rabbi Simon? Because it's a health thing. It's not, I mean, I guess if you say I don't talk, that would be rude to them, right? But just to say that now we know it's bad, just because they did, it's not really human now.
So Eric is raising a secondary, which is a very important point. If somebody today were to say, let's say Rabbi Halevi wants to prohibit it, he can say with all great respect to our predecessors, I'm not saying that they did anything wrong. They didn't know better. In order, they were working with their science, but now we must work with our science. Just like if rabbis in the 17th century went to doctors who practiced 17th century medicine, we wouldn't criticize them. We would criticize somebody who today went to somebody who practiced 17th century medicine. But in other words, the job of the rabbis, as well as everybody else, we must do the best we can with what we got. So Eric is saying it's a very easy way to prohibit something that was previously permissible without showing any disrespect at all. So Rabbi Halevi actually is the very first rabbi on record to come out and publicly prohibit smoking. It was 1976, he was ahead of everybody. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein permitted it. He was reluctant to prohibit because he just had too many great righteous people smoke. He didn't want to make an outright ruling against them.
About my
medical what? That's a whole nother. That's another can of worms. Fine. Okay, but smoking, the issue of smoking isn't that it heals. The issue of smoking is that it kills. Right? So that's, you know, it's fine. So that's the difference. So Rabbi Halevi was actually, as far as I know, the first rabbi to just say, look, he followed Eric's rule. Right? He just said, look, with great respect to all of our predecessors, I'm not disagreeing with them. If I lived in 1920, I would have been a smoker too, right? Or at least I wouldn't have prohibited it. But now that we know what we know, and he said this in 1976, by now the research is far stronger. But in 76, he said the research is sufficient to outlaw it on a biblical level, that from this moment going forward, it's prohibited. It was the great bastion of halachic reporting. The New York Times covered this.
Didn't Maimonides say the same thing?
He said that we have to watch our health.
No, yeah, watch our health.
Correct, so that's what Rabbi Halevi said. The principle is, the eternal principle is, we need to do things that are healthful and we're not allowed to harm our bodies. The reason why earlier generations of rabbis permitted smoking is because they didn't realize, they just didn't know. That's not a criticism of them. They used the best science that they had available. But to remain blind to contemporary science is prohibited. We're not allowed to do that. So Rabbi Halevi was the first one on record to outlaw smoking. Now here's where Rabbi Halevi is going to sound a little inconsistent. Here's a real tricky one. I love this one. This is one of my all-time favorite cases. The halakhic principle, it's a biblical law, we're not allowed to kill animals on Shabbat. It's one of the oral law understands that there are 39 categories when it says in the Torah, you're not allowed to work. So what does that mean? The oral law defines 39 categories of prohibited labor. One of those categories is we're not allowed to kill other living beings, meaning animals. Okay? That's the rule. But the Talmud permits us to kill lice and other kinds of worms, not all worms, on Shabbat. Permits us to kill lice and certain types of worms, particularly the ones that you find in your apple and other foods. And the reason why they permitted it, as Rambam said, and Rambam believed this also, is because these animals are not defined as animals. Why? Because they're not born from a father and a mother. How are lice and these worms in your apples created? if you live in the Talmudic period or if you live in Rambam's 12th century. How did these worms come about and how did these lights come about? Spontaneous generation. They really believed, that was their science, right? That these animals grow from the dust. These animals grow from your fruit. They actually don't come from eggs. And therefore, it's permitting us to kill these, what we, you and I might call animals, these bugs. We're not allowed to kill all bugs, according to the Talmud. The bugs that the Talmud understood came from eggs. Can't kill them because they're animals like anything else. But the Talmud is a halakhic definition of an animal. It's got to be born through...
Lice come from eggs.
Oh, so you're such a smart man. You're right.
We now know.
That's our problem.
They didn't know that then.
In the 19th century, spontaneous generation was completely debunked and refuted. And now we know that all of these animals that grow in your apples and grow in your bananas and the stuff that crawls around in kids' hair, hopefully not for too long, and we get rid of them, all of these things come from eggs. They are animals. So does the rule change for them? Is it now prohibited to kill these animals like any other one because we're not allowed to kill animals on Shabbat?
So you cut it out.
So somebody called in Rabbi Halevi and asked that one. So what's the rule?
You wait till the next day.
Wait till the next day. But the Talmud says you can squish them right now. Yeah? Huh? Okay, let's assume that they're not dangerous. Let's assume they're just irritating or annoying. Forget about any potential threats from these things. Let's just assume, okay, it's irritating. But there's no life, let's assume that there's no life-threatening problem of having a worm in your apple or lice in your hair. It's crummy, I don't recommend it, but it's not necessarily dangerous, at least not for the short term. So what do you do?
Cut it out.
Are you allowed to cut it out on Shabbat? Do we follow the...
You're cutting an apple. Cut out the apple.
Well, certainly don't eat the bug, that's gross anyway.
That's right.
But the question is, are you allowed to squish it?
No.
That's what's at stake here. In other words, we're not allowed to swat a fly. We're not allowed to kill a bee. We're not allowed to kill any animal that's defined as an animal. Question is, does our definition of animal change once we have completely disproven spontaneous generation? Good morning. So poor Rabbi Halevi is in a quandary here. Unlike solar eclipses, where he was willing to back away from the Talmudic understanding of an eclipse being a sign of a curse, and unlike smoking, where he said, look, there's nothing wrong with saying that smoking is dangerous today. It was dangerous 200 years ago, but they just didn't know that then. Okay. Here there's a problem because the actual law would change. In other words, if he says it's prohibited to kill a louse or to kill a worm in your apple, he would be saying that the law of the sages changes. That's what's at stake. So even though he understands, okay, there's no such thing, he's not going to dogmatically insist on spontaneous generation, he doesn't. He's really hard-pressed to prohibit killing these bugs on Shabbat. By the way, just personally, I'll just say, I recommend, please don't kill these things on Shabbat, because of course they are animals, right? But Rabbi Halevi was afraid to make a ruling, because that ruling wouldn't just be, it would be saying that the Talmud and Rambam had it wrong. Even though, by the way, they did have it wrong, just based on their own science, right? There's no criticism of that. They simply were using the best science that they had available. Rabbi Halevi was reluctant to prohibit killing a louse or a worm in this particular instance, just because of this clash with science. I'll give you one other example where Rabbi Halevi was afraid to change a law. The Talmud says that we're not allowed to eat meat and fish prepared together. And to this day, most kosher caterers will keep them in separate platters. If you go to somebody's house and they serve gefilte fish followed by the meal, they'll have two different forks, even a different plate.
Yeah.
And so first you'll get the fish and the salad or whatever you're getting over there, and then that goes. And then out comes the meat stuff.
And sometimes they even have a drink between them.
Yes. The Talmud rules that we're not allowed to cook meat and fish together. Now, it's not the Torah outlaws meat and milk together. Because that's what God says. Okay. And, you know, people, we spoke about whether we can pinpoint a reason for that. The Talmud expressly says the reason why meat and fish are prohibited together is because it's dangerous. It's bad for your health. It's a health problem. It has nothing to do with halakhic principles. It's just the broader principle of we're not allowed to endanger ourselves. So I know a lot of people who eat meat and fish together, and they're fine. And you might know a lot of people who eat meat and fish together, and they're fine too. Smoking kills. It doesn't always, it doesn't cause, as we all know, but it certainly increases severely the likelihood of health problems. But meat and fish, nobody can demonstrate that they increase health risk at all. So what do you do now? The Talmud itself rules against fish and meat together, and it even tells you why. It tells you it's because it's bad for your health. Let's say science shows it's not bad for your health. Should it then become permissible to have meat and fish together? Because it's, again, it's a Talmudic law. What should we do?
One can call it tradition.
Become vegetarian.
Oh. Well, I don't like fish anyway. So, what? Huh?
That's being a vegetarian is the ultimate aim anyway.
Wow, you don't like fish.
I'm aware of that. That's a separate issue, which is also interesting, but it's not a halakha and science question. Here's a halakha. That's just based on a typo. It is. When Rabbi Yosef Karo discusses the prohibition of fish and meat, actually, in one place, some copyist copied it wrong, and it says fish and milk. And he didn't codify that as law, but since it's on the book somewhere, right away, certain communities said, oh, I guess we can't have a bagel and cream cheese and lox. Or salmon sauteed in butter, or anything else involving fish and milk. But that's purely, as all rabbis understand, that's purely based on a typo. Literally. And then the question is, do you get rid of a minhag based on a typo? But this isn't based on a typo. This is based on a Talmudic understanding of a health hazard. Yeah, Phyllis? Right? I like that answer. Rabbi Alevi took a different track. I like your answer better, actually, for this one. But anyway, yeah, Phyllis? Right. So again, because it's a Talmudic prohibition, Rabbi Halevi bristles at saying it's okay, even though he's aware. He says, look, it's a tough question. You know, he starts hemming and hawing a little bit because he doesn't want to come along and say that since the science behind the law is incorrect or has been demonstrated to be incorrect, therefore the halakha must change, right? Which is what Phyllis is doing is adopting a consistent position. Correct, but that's saying that we believe that knowledge to be incorrect. In other words, we don't think that it's unhelpful anymore. So by the way, my brother-in-law Don, by the way, gives a good explanation for, the sages didn't just think something was unhealthy unless they had empirical evidence. They must have really thought that it was unhealthy. This isn't superstition. So he suggested what probably happened was salmonella. That in the good old days, the Talmud even talks about it. They used to make, you think that we Jews in fancy kosher restaurants like rare meat? In the good old days, they liked it really rare. They hardly cooked it at all. It was basically seared meat. Whereas fish, they cooked more thoroughly. So what they must have observed is if you have salmon and meat and you prepare them together and you cook the salmon well, but you cook the meat not so well, the meat will get the salmonella. And you're not destroying it. So that's actually, it actually created a real health hazard back in the good old days. I think it's a great theory.
What is the bones? That because you have to be wary of bones and fish, so if you mix it with something else, you won't be so apt to sort of be.
That also might be a reason for that. So you could very well be. Either way, they observed some genuine danger. I don't think that they were just, this wasn't just a random thing. They had empirical evidence to support what, they didn't know why it was, whether it was the bones or whether it was salmonella, which they really would not have known. They just observed that more people who have fish and meat together get ill, even sometimes dangerously so, than people who just have fish separate and meat separate. They didn't know why, they just said, don't do it. Okay, so to follow Phyllis's premise, it would just be, okay, prepare the meat better and cook it better and wash everything better and make sure to cook things thoroughly, you won't get sick, and that's the reality, right? Avi takes a separate approach, which the Chatam Sofer also took in the 19th century. He said, look, you're right. Fish and meat are not dangerous together anymore. We see that with our own eyes, but it's the minhag. It's become a tradition. So he didn't want to abolish the rule, not because he was insisting on rabbinic science, but because he just felt for centuries Jews didn't have fish and meat together, let's just keep doing that. I actually think that either one of those views is more consistent. Rabbi Halevi was stuck in his dilemma. He didn't want to say what Avi said, because he didn't want to officially concede that a science behind a law was wrong. And therefore he said, better not to do it because we're just not, better not to have fish and meat together because we're not sure. Maybe it really is dangerous and we're just not sure. Which is consistent to the way he thought about things, even though I like what either Phyllis or Avi would say. In practice, kosher catering outfits continue to separate fish and meat, and most kosher homes continue to separate fish and meat. But I'd rather say that we're doing it because it's the minhag than to say that it might actually be dangerous.
But the minhag is based on a total mistake even then. It's not as if science changed and it's like it's not a problem.
But it's still.
They happen to have a mistake in terms of cooking. That was their problem.
Well, it was valid then, because probably people did get ill then.
People got ill for a lot of different things, but they weren't necessarily getting ill because of that.
Your question is right. Your question is perfectly, you know, it's consistent. I'm just telling you that Rabbi Halevi, you can agree or disagree with this principle. Rabbi Halevi is not alone in this. Most poskim, most halakhic decisors are extremely, extremely reluctant to change a Talmudic law. And it was both in the case of squishing a louse, which again, it's a permissive ruling of the Talmud. It's so easy to just say, everybody's looking for a chumrah, right? Here's a Torah prohibition in play. Everybody's looking for, you know, tertiary rabbinic maybe, and they outlaw that. Here's something that's a biblical law, right? In other words, Shabbat violation is in play here. And in our mind, if you squish a louse, you're violating Shabbat. Most rabbis are reluctant to say that you're violating Shabbat because that would mean overruling a Talmudic law. And the same thing in this case, it's reversed. The Talmud ruled, it's a law. Don't eat it, why? Because it's dangerous. So even though you and I would say, but it's not dangerous anymore, Rabbi Halevi and others are reluctant for the most part. Some rabbis did permit it. Some rabbis permitted having fish and meat together. They said, look, whatever bothered the sages doesn't bother us, go ahead. You know, and since the sages give the reason for their law, that it's because of danger, that's a consistent position. Rabbi Halevi is stuck. I mean, he's consistent to the way he thinks about the world. I'm trying to present his way, not as the only way or the right way, but just he didn't want to take any law of the Talmud and undermine it even based on current scientific knowledge. That was his premise. That's how he dealt with it. One thing that Rabbi Halevi joined a lot of rabbis, but not all, given that most of the Jewish world is less observant than it used to be religiously, a lot of laws are based on the idea that the Jewish community is observant. So I think I mentioned last week, the Talmudic sources and later rabbinic sources treat Shabbat violators as idolaters. It's as though they've broken rank with the Jewish community and they're excluding themselves, they're rebels. Rabbi Halevi joined a chorus of most rabbis today, rightly so, in saying that we no longer can view Jews who violate Shabbat as rebels. It's still, every Jew should keep Shabbat. You know, the principle remains the same, but we can't legally view Jews who are less observant as sinners in the same way that the Talmud did, because in the Talmudic period, everybody kept Shabbat. If a Jew would publicly flout Shabbat, that was his way of saying, I'm out of here. It's like wearing a cross. That's really what it would be like in the olden days. Nowadays, many Jews with very strong Jewish identities love Judaism. They might even drive to synagogue, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're not allowed to do that, but they might drive to synagogue, and that obviously shows that they want to be connected with the Jewish community, right? And even if they're not driving to synagogue, let's say they drive to the beach, okay, so that's also wrong, but they don't necessarily want to discard their Jewish identity. They just define themselves differently from the way that they were. So Rabbi Halevi, as well as many, many, many other rabbis beginning in the 19th century ruled, we cannot view any Jew who violates Shabbat anymore as an idolater. We have to view them as people who are making a mistake, but part of the family, which is a very inclusive position that on some level had to be taken, but on some level it's a principle change. It's that we no longer view Jews who sin in the same way as we did 400 years ago, when people were breaking from a traditional community. Even one person called him up, he said, a fully observant Jew, he said, I live in a neighborhood where the only synagogue has one minyan, and there's 9 other men, and none of them keep Shabbat. I don't want to pray with them because they're Shabbat violators. But if I don't show up, then they don't have a minyan. What should I do? So Rabbi Halevi, how to
show up?
He said, you better go. He said, if that synagogue closes because of you, you're committing a terrible sin. Like, hopefully one day these other 9 people will keep Shabbat, but bless them. They're coming to synagogue every day. They're obviously not breaking from the Jewish community. And you should go there and help them fulfill a minyan, and you should pray with them, and that's the right thing to do. Yeah.
There's a famous story about David Solomon's school when Shabbat he was downstairs at the synagogue. He ran into a young congregant who lived in Washington Heights or elsewhere and apologized to him that he had come down by subway. And so, did I ask you how you got here?
Right. No, it's absolutely, yeah, Benjamin. That also was bad.
No, but I'm trying to bring out is that maybe not everybody observed the rules like
that. Your point is very well taken. I don't want to over-idealize observance in the pre-modern era. I think that's what Benjamin is driving at correctly. There always were people who were doing things that weren't so okay. And it wasn't 100% observant, that's true. But public violation of Shabbat in the pre-modern period was truly an anomaly. In other words, if people were doing stuff in their homes, they still didn't want to be caught violating Shabbat. And in fact, the Talmud specifically classifies a public Shabbat violator as one who's walking away. Because that was a way of saying, in your face, I really don't care. Whereas today, Jews who violate Shabbat in public, for the most part, really don't realize the magnitude of what they are doing. They simply don't, they never were taught, or our society doesn't foster the sense of awe of what Shabbat is supposed to be. So visionary rabbis like Rabbi Halevi, and already in the 19th century Germany, that's where it all went down originally, they realized we have to think about these people differently. They're no longer breaking from the community. They're the majority and we're the minority. Those of us who keep Shabbat are the minority. So we know we're doing the right thing, but we can't anymore rule out the broader Jewish community because they're not trying to break away in the same sense. Another interesting question that came up to Rabbi Halevi was, can women study Talmud? May women study Talmud? Can they? Of course, but may they? Now you might think that, well, sure, duh, Torah study is good, right? It sounds like the most biggest no-brainer of all. Well, if you have source number 3, the first two sources, which we did not read inside, by the way, the first one is just the source in the Talmud about eclipses being bad, sign of divine wrath. Source number 2 is about the lice. So you have them for your records. Those are the sources that we did not read inside. Source number 3, Rambam makes a ruling. Again, the 12th century, and Rambam is Rambam. Rambam always, he rides with us in every sense of the way. So he's talking about the laws of Torah study in general. And he says, even though a woman study Torah will receive reward, the sages commanded that one should not teach his daughter Torah because most women cannot concentrate their attention on study, and thus transform the words of Torah into idle matters because of their lack of understanding. The sages teach that anyone who teaches his daughter Torah teaches her idle things. The statement is in regard to the oral law. That's Rambam's innovation, by the way. But with regard to the written law, initially one should not teach one's daughter. However, if one teaches her, it is not considered as if she was taught idle things. It's an amazing passage, especially for 21st century ears. But for Rambam, this was a no-brainer. The Talmud itself discusses with some reluctance a father's obligation to teach. We all know the official law is men are obligated to study Torah and women are not obligated in the same way, but I would think it's still a good thing, right? That's my gut starting assumption. They just don't have to have formal education in the same sense. That's the Talmudic principle.
Weren't they influenced by the outside?
Oh, so Sam is, okay. There's no question that there was that was the culture of that time. But as always, Sam, what you're raising is exactly the question that every halakhist has to deal with. Namely, what is principle and what is temporal? Anything that's time-bound, like scientific understandings of the sages, okay, so that's something that we can disagree with, but we're not disagreeing with a principle. But if we decide that something is a principle, well, then it's a principle. And that's the part that's eternal, and then we have to figure out how to best apply it. Megan, just in time for the good stuff.
Okay.
All right. So Rambam, let me just summarize where we're at, and then we'll get to you, Benjamin. Hold one second, Moshe. Rambam took the Talmudic passages and synthesized them and actually innovated here. But he's making a ruling that's a clear-cut ruling, which is, what's a father's obligation toward his daughters? If he educates her in what we call Tanakh, the Bible, he doesn't have to, but if he does it, that's fine. But Talmud, the oral law, he's not allowed to. Why? Because most women are incapable of understanding Talmud. That's Rambam's, now again, he's predicating that as a ruling. He's not just giving advice. He's saying, this is the law. Mm-hmm. Okay, Benjamin? Oh, by the way, not only Benjamin, you and Rabbi Soloveitchik are the same on this one. Rabbi Soloveitchik specifically describes his parents' religious influence in this regard. Don't worry, I'm not making an absolute analogy. But Rabbi Soloveitchik actually describes his father's religious education to him in terms of intense text study. He's my rabbi and teacher. He taught me everything I know about learning Talmud, about learning halakha, about, you know, the whole intellectual side of Judaism. He said, my mother taught me how to live Judaism. She was a... That we always expected that. And as Rabbi Soloveitchik tries to create typologies, obviously gender-specific here, where the man's obligation is A and the woman's obligation is B. And that certainly was likely to be traditionally what was done on some level or another. Obviously, different communities had different styles and, you know, different education for women, you know, that's what historians spend a lot of time studying. But before we get over back to your point, what did Moshe want to say? It's an interesting question. I mean, honestly, you never know. I mean, you can always try to figure out the history behind a context of a certain statement. The legal passage where the Talmud discusses it actually has to do with the sotah, the suspected adulteress. Mm. And the logic is, it says that if a woman has merit, then the waters of the sotah don't try her if she is suspected for committing adultery. So one rabbi said, oh, therefore it's a good idea to teach her Torah because that'll protect her. And another rabbi said, but if you teach her Torah, then she'll seclude herself with a man, and she'll say, oh, the waters won't get me anyway. So therefore, it's a bad idea. So if you look at the legal context of the Talmud, it's not talking about women's intellectual capacities at all, like the way Rambam frames it. Rambam can't help himself. He's the supreme intellectual. But the Talmud is talking about, will Torah study embolden a woman to then say, I have so much merit, I can commit adultery too? That's the, which again, you can certainly weigh the relative merits of whether or not you want to have formal education for women on that basis, right? And certainly in our day where you don't have sotah at all, it seems like we're somewhere else. Rambam completely abstracted that discussion, took it away from sotah, took it away from the suspected adulteress, and moved it into the realm of the intellectual ability of women. And he said, since most women cannot do it, therefore, we cannot teach them oral law, even if a father wants to. That's his law. So Rabbi Halevi was asked. Somebody calls him up on the show and says, can we teach our daughters Talmud? So of course, Rabbi Halevi is not going to say Rambam, well, we live in a different era, so Rambam's irrelevant. There's no such thing as Rambam being irrelevant, right? So he quotes Rambam, and he says, what does Rambam say? Rambam gives a reason why women can't study Talmud. Why? Because most women are incapable intellectually of doing it. So Rabbi Halevi said, look, in the 12th century, the reason why most women were intellectually incapable is because they got no formal education at all. Mm-hmm. If you try to teach nuclear physics to a four-year-old, unless it happens to be four-year-old Einstein, it's not going to work. Not because you're doing anything atrocious, but because the kid can't handle it. So in Rambam's day, women got no formal education at all for the most part. Maybe a couple of the aristocracy got private tutors and were incredibly educated. There always were some educated women, but certainly not the society. So Rambam was simply basing his ruling on empirical evidence. So Rabbi Halevi said, if you have a girl in high school who's motivated to learn, or an adult woman is motivated to learn, and she has a formal education in every other sphere, of course she's capable. So she's not, so how does he formulate it? He says, such a woman is not part of Rambam's majority. They're part of the minority. And therefore, of course, it's okay to study Talmud. And by the way, that would mean even if 100% of women are motivated this way, and 100% of women would then study Talmud, by the way, I would love that. That would be great. It would be so excellent if all Jewish women and all Jewish men and all boys and girls got a great Jewish education and all learned everything. Rabbi Halevi would say that's fine within Rambam. What does he not want to do? He doesn't want to disagree with Rambam, right? And so he's coming up, and I don't think that this is gymnastics. He's simply arguing that Rambam says why he made his ruling. It's not based on some fundamental principle, women are not allowed to do this. It's that people who are incapable of learning Talmud should not study it. Yeah, Elisa.
I'm thinking of this as more practical, certainly in terms of the time and multitasking. Like in our day and age, everybody's sort of a superhuman person, and that's why I think everybody has ADD, because we've committed to doing so many things. I mean, a woman could be a homemaker and an attorney and taking care of her children and being involved in so many different things. And that's sort of a norm, and I think it's taken a toll. But people are committed to sort of keeping up that, you know, crazy lifestyle. And I think back then, I mean, just thinking about practically running a house, you know, they didn't go to the store and buy the butter. They churned the butter. That took quite some time.
That's right.
All the practical things of running a house took way more time. And I think that was probably where the thought was, how could you be concerned about doing the laundry and churning the butter and, you know, whatever the domesticated things were, and also intellectualize. I mean, it's a very different time.
That's absolutely right. So that's Rabbi Halevi, and Rabbi Halevi agrees with what you're saying. He just couches it differently intentionally. He doesn't want to say, since we live in a different era, this law no longer applies. What he's saying is, Rambam's ruling is predicated on his perception that most women can't do this because most women had no education at all.
That's a fear as a man also. Who would want their woman to do that? I mean, then
that's a different psychological, sociological point, which is also very relevant. But Rambam wasn't necessarily threatened by a learned woman. He just said, in his perception, how could a woman possibly study this abstract law if they, you know, in other words, everybody agreed, all rabbis agreed, we have to teach girls and women laws that they need to observe. They need to know what to do. But studying Talmud means getting to the roots of it. It's abstracted. So he said, a woman without a general education certainly will not be able to study Talmud either. Rabbi Halevi said, that's true, but today most girls get a good solid education, and therefore they are capable of learning Talmud. So he says anybody who's motivated to do so should. And it's within, it's still agreeing with your sociological point. Just to give you a contrast, the religious kibbutz movement made a ruling that Rambam's laws no longer apply, it applies because we live in a different era, and therefore girls should learn Talmud. So it sounds like they and Rabbi Halevi are in agreement, because they both say, in the olden days, girls did not study Talmud, and today we do, right? But Rabbi Halevi blew a stack at them. How dare you say that Rambam is obsolete? He says the whole point is that we can work within the classical sources to show. He said that as soon as you break from the classical sources, then it's not halakha anymore. Halakha is using the classical sources to show how do you apply the principle to today. Megan?
I was just thinking that if he was such a big intellectual, how come he couldn't figure out that women needed an education altogether, let alone the Talmud? I mean it, because it's very sad to hear. It's very sad for me.
Right. I'll try to make you a little less distressed without apologizing for. In other words, I agree with you, but just to make you a little less distressed, you have to remember in the 12th century, that's what everybody thought. You would have thought that too, as a woman, you would have thought that.
It's, yeah, like, it's more sad.
So
even
okay.
More sad.
So you and I agree that on this particular issue, thank God, women get a much better education today and obviously have proven themselves to excel in every field. That's something that for us is so normal, we can't imagine that anybody ever thought otherwise.
I can imagine it, but he could have been a stellar intellectual by changing things, by being a force for
that
change.
Wasn't, I think Elisa's point is well taken in terms of just the practical day-to-day life of what 12th century life was and how the community functioned. Okay, Avi? Well, I don't think that's what he would say, right? No. But in other words, Sam says something very important before. Sam always says things that are important. But in this particular, his principle in terms of We have what God said in the Torah. We have what God revealed orally. Then we have the authority of the sages. Once we move to actual authority of sages, that's human. Everybody agrees, right? The blurry part is that we've accepted the authority of the sages, not as the equivalent of God's word. That's what's important. In other words, the rabbinic tradition has accepted fully the authority of the Talmud in law, not in science or in history, but in law. And that's what, but it's human, correct. Correct, and with Rambam also. Nobody thinks that, I mean, Rambam was a genius, but he still is a human being, and he's still living in a context, which is why Elisa and Megan's points are so cogent in terms of that. Shalom.
I guess part of what I'm getting from this is, I guess I wanted to believe that these sages were ahead of their time. That sort of helps my emunah. Not that they sort of, they were subject to the same false beliefs as everybody else at the time.
Right.
Because there's so many other things where they seem so sharp and so modern.
They were so ahead of their time, but they still might not be to our standards of everything that we would like to see. There's an evolution. They always were ahead of their time. In terms of their, even specifically in their rulings for women, they bent over, even the ketubah, right, which is 2,000 years old. That was an amazing women's rights thing where they said, we will not perform a wedding without a ketubah, right? And that was to protect women because men were just flying the coop totally without any consequence. The rabbi said, we're not going to tolerate that. They were way ahead of their time. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that they were thinking the way that you and I think. Right? So I don't hold that against them at all. I think if somebody today continues to insist on certain principles that are Talmudic or Rambam or whatever, and dogmatically, that's the problem. So Rabbi Halevi reminds us, and that's, again, he's doing this juggling act. I think he does a splendid job, whether or not agree or disagree with every one of his points. He does a splendid job in trying to work out how are you in tune with today fully, and simultaneously being absolutely deferential to the past. And that's what he's balancing.
Already, Yeshiva, they don't teach girls to talk.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
How did they handle it?
A couple more things, and then, yeah, Steve.
So back in the day, what percentage of men were literate?
Okay, Jews in general were way more literate than the rest of society, as any historian would tell you. It doesn't mean that every Jewish kid, got a PhD or went to, got smicha. That was still a very tiny percentage. Most had to work at a very early age. But at least there was some formal instruction for many, and certainly much more than in the broader society. Elisa?
How does these sages handle Deborah?
Did the rabbis of the Talmud understand themselves as evolving rabbis? In other words, did they imagine that their law would be finite? Or I'm sure they imagined that this system would go on forever, and that they were sort of considering halacha in their time, and imagine that the rabbis of the 21st century would continue and explain halacha in their terms. I think something went awry, but I don't think the rabbis initially understood that. They were living in their times, and imagine Judaism would be alive going forward.
And specifically, there's one Talmudic passage, and then I have to just say, one Talmudic passage that Elisa is speaking to very directly. It's a fabulous story. Story that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's up on Mount Sinai, God takes him on a little futuristic time travel, and he gets to sit in the classes of Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest Tanaim, one of the greatest rabbis of the first, second century CE. And Moshe Rabbeinu is sitting, he's a fly on the wall in the back of the room, and Rabbi Akiva is teaching Torah, and Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't understand a word. And he's sitting there getting all depressed, here's Moshe Rabbeinu, God's star pupil, and he doesn't understand Rabbi Akiva. So finally, at one point, one of Rabbi Akiva's students asked Rabbi Akiva, how do you know that? And he says, God taught it to Moshe, and then Moshe felt better. What's the Talmud teaching on a very fundamental level? The Talmud is conscious of the fact that already the sages' Judaism is different from Moshe's Judaism. Moshe would not have understood the sages' observance, and the sages wouldn't fully understand our world. But the Talmud is conscious of the fact that there's this process, that halakha is eternal, but it needs to be able to always apply to our time. And that brings us, yeah.
Sages handled Deborah.
We talked about her last time. They liked her very much. Now, on one last point that Rabbi Halevi dealt with is the founding of the State of Israel, which he took very, very, very seriously. So just to give a, he felt it was a religious, it was a sacrilege to not see religious value in the founding of the state. Obviously it's not a perfect state by any stretch, but he said that to say that nothing happened in 1948 is a sacrilege. Not just that you're crazy, but he fundamentally disagreed with those who poo-pooed the religious significance of the founding of the State of Israel. He said Hallel on Yom Atzma'ut and Yom Yerushalayim after it was reunited. He realized that something was different. One very interesting, he made two rulings that I want to wrap up with. One is that he said that rabbis should never make rulings on national policy, on politics, on security matters. The halakhic principle is we need to take care of ourselves and we need to take care of our country. But he says rabbis don't know the inner workings of politics. They're not generals. If there's a rabbi who's a general or a prime minister, it's another ballgame. But he said for rabbis to just sit on the sidelines and impose, oh, it's prohibited to do this or that or to make this or that deal based on what they saw online. Oh, certain rabbis don't have online, of course, but what they read in the papers or what they saw on the internet or what they hear, it's an outrage. Rabbis have no ability to make rulings on things that they don't have all the facts. Rabbis always need all the facts, so they cannot make rulings. So he said, as a matter of principle, rabbis are allowed to have political opinions like any other voter, and they're allowed to vote for the politicians they want to vote for, but they can't say, this is what Judaism says about this particular deal. That was one very important principle that he made, and he made it time and again, was disappointed when rabbis would get on public, and rabbis still do that, and make rulings on what the government should do. They're allowed to have opinions. Anybody's allowed to have an opinion. But there's no privileged opinion for being a rabbi here. Everybody agrees Israel should be safe and secure, amen. But there are debates about how to get there best. And rabbis don't know better than anybody else how to make that happen. And so he was very insistent on that point. One last point, somebody called them up and said, what do you prefer? That religious men, should they go to the army or not? Or should they learn in yeshivot all day? He gave the best answer I've ever heard to this question. Best. Because you know, everybody has a very strong stand on that, and honestly, that's one of the most important divisive issues in Israel. So first of all, he made a statement of faith. He said, if every Jew were to study Torah and be religious, we would not need an IDF. I don't have that faith at all. We need an IDF, and may God bless them and protect all of them. But he really believed that may all Jews become religious also, but we still should have an IDF until further notified. Like when Mashiach comes, all right, then the IDF can go home. But short of that, I wouldn't rely on supernatural intervention. But he said, in principle, people who learn Torah full time are doing something wondrous. That was point number one. Point number two, he said, most people who are in kolels don't learn Torah full time. They're scammers and they desecrate God's name.
It is true.
He said the only people who should be learning Torah full-time are the people who genuinely are motivated day and night to knock themselves out of the fear of heaven to study Torah full-time. He said those people are admirable. But he said anybody who's a scammer, not only are they violating state law, but they're desecrating God's name. Then he said that the rule of military exemption for yeshiva students, according to halakha, applies only in peacetime. But when there's a war going on, everybody's got to drop their Talmud, or in my ideal world, also drop their Tanakh, and go out and fight, or at least do kitchen duty or medical duty. Not everybody needs a gun, but everybody must actively serve the country during war times. He quoted a story of Rabbi Uziel, his mentor, that in 1948, some yeshiva student said, Rabbi Uziel, can you please exempt us from going to fight in the War of Independence? Rabbi Uziel said, if I weren't such an old man, I would pick up a gun and go to the front lines myself. Get out there and fight. That's the law.
Rabbi Halevi wasn't there.
And Rabbi Halevi served. But to him, it's a matter of principle. Even if he never served personally, during wartime, he would have gotten up and served the country directly. So Rabbi Halevi then, after going through all of that, said that the best model is what we call yeshivot hasder, those yeshiva students who spend part of the time in the army and part of the time learning, because they not only serve God properly, but they also, it's more palatable to the state. The public doesn't understand this idea of full-time Torah study protecting Israel with its merit. They understand, okay, these guys are going to tanks also, or they're going into doing whatever they did. So he preferred that in the end. But I liked the nuance that he gave to that question as opposed to just taking an absolute stand, one or the other. To conclude, Sam, I'll take your question afterwards. We're just out of time, and I always want to begin and end on time is important in my ethic. Rabbi Halevi, following Rabbi Uziel, are two of the best models out there of having absolute fidelity to Talmudic and rabbinic tradition. They were masters of it all, but at the same time, they understood very well how you must have two eyes open to today. And where one draws the line of what's principle in halakha and what's sociological or conditioned by science or conditioned by a social reality of the 12th century, whatever it is, that's something that every rabbi has to figure out for himself and then argue in discourse. I think Rabbi Halevi, followed by Rabbi Uziel, had some of the most impressive track records of just having a consistent party line to make life in Israel, understanding the new dynamic of women and of family dynamics, understanding a new world where most Jews are not observant. They had an absolutely inclusive policy to making sure that everybody should love all Jews, not only those who are fully observant, and so much more. I wish that people like that would still be chief rabbis. I wish that people like that would still be, you know, being produced in great numbers, because they really were two of the greatest people of the 20th century. On that happy note, next week we are going to do conversion. We're not going to actually perform a conversion in the bank. We're going to study the laws of conversion, at least some of the basic principles, because that's one of the hotly contested things that are out there, and also because it really cuts to the heart of what is Jewish identity today. So we'll talk about that next week.